It's me, Max Cherney, listening to Video Nom Noms. Thank you for listening. I'm going to take this hit. I just took a small one. And let me just check something here. Okay. Hopefully you're hearing me okay and the recording is okay. I checked it last night. I was all paranoid about it. And it sounded okay to me. When I do move the microphone away from my face, the audio quality does dip. Not necessarily the quality, but the volume, I noticed. So I'll try to keep it close to my face. I'll try to speak louder when I have it. Because, like, I'll put it down on the chair when I take a hit and stuff. But generally, I like to have the mic in my hand when I'm actually recording in a proper podcast studio, if that ever happens. I would like to have a handheld mic as opposed to, you know, a Joe Rogan stationary mic. Anyway, I like recording in my car. And I hope you like listening to it. So I already sterilized the bowl. Do a little quick more sterilization. I finished the bowl from this morning that I had smoked on before work. Re-listened to Quentin Tarantino by RZA and Flatbush Zombies. I enjoy the song. I dig it. There are a couple of things that don't quite work for me about it. First of all, the musical intro sounds like GoldenEye music. I don't know what that has to do with Quentin Tarantino. And I love RZA. I think he's a brilliant producer. RZA might actually be my favorite producer of all time. I'm thinking about it now. Yeah, he's my favorite. Well, along with Madlib. I would say Madlib first, then RZA. In terms of like top producers, hip-hop producers of all time. I think he's a genius. But on this song, yeah, I don't know. That part just seemed a little weird to me. Like, what does that have to do with Quentin Tarantino? Like, in this case, like, you should really stick with the theme, especially if it's Tarantino. And Tarantino doesn't make Bond movies. Although they did make Casino Royale because of Tarantino. But I won't get into that right now. So, yeah, other than that, I love the song, except for one other thing. They mention every Tarantino movie is mentioned in the song, except for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, strangely, is never mentioned. And Inglourious Basterds is never mentioned. Although, if you look at the cover art for the single, on the guy's stomach, it looks like the word glorious is written. So I don't know if that's like an oblique reference. And I also don't know if they didn't include it because it's because of Nazi shit. I don't know. They didn't want to include Inglourious. Every other movie they did mention, especially this one guy's verse. I think he's the second guy that raps. He manages to mention every Tarantino movie, including Jackie Brown, including Death Proof, including The Hateful Eight. I mean, they're all in there. Django, No Inglourious, Inglourious. Ooh. That was bad. Reservoir Dogs is even mentioned. And then Pulp Fiction, I don't think he mentions, but then RZA's like, what the fuck's up in that briefcase? And I thought that was, I wasn't like told all in on that. I thought that was a little corny, but I don't know. Other than that, the song's dope. I'm going to watch the video. I shared it on Twitter. If you haven't seen it, check it out. Follow Video Nasties on Twitter at VideoNasties1. And smoke if you got them. Chin chin. I'm doing it. So that was my first massive rip of the day. Luckily, I didn't cough. I'm still smoking on that delicious Jiggler shit from Resonate. Oh, I forgot to tag Shine Your Light. But I didn't actually post a post promoting the new app, so I guess it's alright. So, yeah, that was my first massive rip of the day. I did take a hit this morning, and then I went into work, and there was like a mix-up. I have like some old food in my car. Not like old, but like from this past week. Sandwiches that I didn't finish, And it's been cold out, so they've been okay in my car. And I did eat part of like one of the sandwiches and one of the bagels. I ate like part of that. I probably shouldn't have done that, especially with the sandwich, because it had some cheese and some mayo on it, and I could see the mayo was getting a little like coagulating in one section. So I don't know what the fuck I was thinking, but like I ate some of that shit this morning, kind of like as I was going into work. And this is gonna get into some weird shit and like some personal shit, but like I do have OCD about shit, and like I did like accidentally bring in like the wrong bagel, and I took a bite of it and it was all cold and shit, and I was like, what, how did I end up bringing this in? And then I was mad at myself, so I had to punish myself. And so I ate some of this old sandwich, but there was, I mean, it was a full fucking sandwich just sitting there. I didn't take one bite of it. I would have had to throw the whole fucking thing out. So I'm glad I ate some of it. You know, I was hungry this morning. I was a little high. I ate some of it and I went into work and I took some great shits today and I'm gonna take another one. And then I was actually reading this like INS health tip on Instagram. They're that the place that follows me that I have mentioned previously. Ooh, Chinese hamburger. Vegan. Sounds delish. Oh, sorry. I might have to go use the bathroom again, but and happy birthday, Steven Spielberg. I actually have a lot to cover on this episode. This might be like a longer one. I still have to work tomorrow, but I go in later. I go in at 11, and then it's Sunday, so it's my last day of the week, so I'm happy about that. And yeah. So, oh, INS, yeah, right. INS, healthy tips, that's it. Useful natural remedies, stay inspired, stay healthy. There it is. Okay. Quote, did you know? The combination of lemon and honey in warm water is an excellent drink for relieving constipation and boosting digestion. This drink aids in colon cleansing and eliminating undigested food and toxins from the body. That's the la that last part is what really spoke to me. This drink aids in colon cleansing and eliminated undigested food and toxins from the body. I want to clear all that shit out. I want my shit to be clean and clear. And this shit will do that for you, apparently. Lemon and honey and warm water. Alright? So fuck with it. What do I want to do now? I don't think I actually have to poop. I think I just had to rip a big fart. Okay, sorry. This is getting gross. But now I'm gonna go take a piss. So it's still gross. You know what? I'm gonna leave it rolling. You might hear some rain in the background. I got some. Hear that? It's not that loud. Got some sound effects going. Real life holy work. All right, I'll be right back. I'm just gonna leave it rolling. 2 seconds. Okay, sorry. Still rolling. Just had to take a quick piss. All right. Enough with the grossness. Let's get into it. So, a lot going on today, a lot going on in this episode. I came home, I saw my stepdad for the first time since he's had the surgery, and the first thing he said to me was, "Can you get the mail?" I'm not even kidding. The most awkward moment of my week, at least. I mean, that shit was so fucking awkward. And then he, after that, I think he felt bad. He kept saying, like, "Oh, thanks for getting the mail." I don't know why I'm talking about this shit. Again, this is, like, too personal. But I was just, like, I was kind of pissed off. But then at the same time, I was so fucking upset this week with the shit that went down with him and how it affected my mom. Mostly that. And the fact that he's even more of an asshole now, that he's even more of a jerk, makes it easier. Like, I don't mind as much if he dies after that. Which, I know how it sounds, I know it sounds terrible, but I, you know, and he was also, like, nice, and, like, his, kind of, like, his old vivacious self. He kind of seemed better in some ways. This is like personal family shit. You know what? I'm going to cut it out. But he seemed good. He was good. But he was also even more of a jerk. But it just makes me give even less of a shit. And it makes this whole process easier. The fact that he's even worse now. It just makes me care about him dying less. Like, I don't mind as much if he dies. But at the same time, for my mom's sake, yeah, I hope he lives a lot longer. I hope he lives for many more years. So that's it. That's all I have to say about that. It's Steven Spielberg's birthday. I mentioned that. I love Steven Spielberg. I'm excited for West Side Story, which segues into the next thing I want to talk about. Actually, before I get into that, I mean, I'm on the topic of Spielberg. I guess this all kind of ties in. There's this dude, Joe Russo, on Twitter. I don't think it's the same Joe Russo that made Avengers Endgame. This seems like a very different Joe Russo. But weirdly, the same name. And I don't know. Guy seems like an asshole. Most people on Twitter seem like assholes. I probably seem like a Twitter on asshole. Woo! Asshole on Twitter. I'm fucking high. And you know what? It makes me out of it. Like, the fact that, like, I'm a little sick from eating that, like, borderline rotten food. It makes me, you know how you get, like, out of it when you're sick? I'm getting, like, a little bit of that out of it-ness. You know what I'm talking about? When you have, like, a cold, even if you have a cold, you're just not quite, like, checked in. Same if you have a fever, even more so if you have a fever. So, all right, this is Joe Russo tweets, at Joe Russo tweets. Quote, this is from 4 hours ago. Right now it's 9:23 p.m., Saturday, November 18th, 2021. Oh, 5 minutes ago we added something. All right, it says, quote, "We got new movies this fall from Steven Spielberg, Guillermo del Toro, Ridley Scott, Edgar Wright, and Wes Anderson, only to let them all be largely ignored at the box office. My heart aches for cinema." And then he's followed it up, like I said, just 5 minutes ago with, quote, "To all the folks saying they are waiting for VOD or streaming for whatever reason, pandemic or otherwise, that business model doesn't work well for these mid-range movies. The path we're on, we're going to end up with tentpoles and micro-budgets and nothing else." I want to, like, leave a comment that just says, we're already there, pretty much. And to prove my point, here's an article from Collider, and it's like most articles that I've found online recently. It's so terribly written that it's actually embarrassing. Quote, "Spider-Man No Way Home box office webs up second best opening of all time with $121 million. And when I read this next part, you'll see what I mean when I say that this is embarrassingly badly written. Quote, "The power of the sun in the palm of my hands," said producer Amy Pascal, probably. I'm not kidding. That's the sub, whatever, the subtext under the title. By Jack King, published 8 hours ago. Fuck you, Jack King. Quote, while we'll have to wait and see how theaters fare over the next couple of weeks, it looks like, so far, Omicron, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, has proven an easy foe for Spidey to wrangle. Spider-Man No Way Home, the hotly anticipated threequel to Tom Holland's Spidey storyline, featuring an all-star ensemble of returning villains, scored big at the box office despite fears over the emergent variant. Its $121 million opening day is the second highest of all time. I'm going to read that again. Its $121.5 million opening day, okay, it made that much in one day on its opening day. This is insane. I have to read it again. Quote, its $121.5 million opening day is the second highest of all time, just behind Avengers Endgame, but remarkably ahead of Star Wars The Force Awakens. Moviegoers are loving it, which bodes well for word of mouth. The film has thwipped an A-plus cinema score. Yes, an A-plus cinema score. The best grade ever for a live-action Spidey flick. That is fucking crazy. It's higher than the fucking Sam Raimi movies, and those movies got good reviews. Even critics have... Oh, sorry. Quote, even critics have, broadly speaking, been fans. It currently has one of the highest Rotten Tomatoes scores of the MCU installments at 94%. This is bested only by the likes of Black Panther, which went on to score a Best Picture nomination. Well, you could say it won the nomination. Quote, which went on to score a Best Picture nomination. This puts the John Watts-directed picture at an estimated $242 to $247.5 million over 3 days, which would score it the fourth highest North American of all time. This is crazy. Oh, I guess he means the fourth highest weekend of all time. Thanks a lot, asshole king. Quote, which would score it the fourth highest North American of all time, behind Endgame, Avengers Infinity War, and The Force Awakens. Suffice to say, if Spidey scores a $250 million debut, it'll be the greatest success of the pandemic era by a country mile. We mean, come on, you need mechanical arms to control financial power this incandescent. Four of them, to be precise. Not that that previous sentence made no sense. Not that we needed it, but here's proof that, on the contrary to what some might believe, theaters are far from dead. Okay, so this is really the only part I give a shit about, although that is crazy. Those numbers are crazy. But this part is actually more interesting to me. Quote, Spidey's only real competition, also in debut, is Guillermo del Toro's comparably small Oscar hopeful Nightmare Alley, which is expecting to make around $3 to $4 million. Friday came in at $1.19 million, not much competition at all. Encanto, Disney's animated feature released last month, came in second with $1.65 million. Nightmare Alley was third. West Side Story, Steven Spielberg's musical remake, came in fourth. Let me read that again. West Side Story, Steven Spielberg's musical remake, came in fourth with $1.06 million. Rounding off the top five is a resolute House of Gooch. House of Gooch, taking $579,359. This is the new Steven Spielberg movie, and it came in fourth. This is the world we live in, people. Quote, while you'll want to avoid giving it a spin if... Oh, I don't give a shit about this. Oh, fuck it, I'll read it. Quote, while you'll want to avoid giving it a spin if you've still not watched the film, some of the later tracks are spoiler-heavy for fans in the know. Be warned, Michael Giacchino's frisson-inducing soundtrack, and it should say score, right? He wrote the score, it's not a soundtrack. Fucking idiot. for No Way Home was released on streaming platforms yesterday. The terrific songsmith has collaborated with Watts on all three of his MCU Spidey trilogy installments and also composed the scores. He's not a songsmith, you fucking retard. And also composed the scores of some of the biggest releases in recent years, including The Incredibles, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, and Jurassic World. Talking about the release, he said, quote, "It really has been special to take this three-movie ride with Peter Parker and our talented director, John Watts. Over the course of the films, Peter grows from a typical teenager with everyday angst, or angst, and awkwardness that so many of us had at that age, to a more confident young adult who understands his great responsibility. The added bonus of being able to travel and play with the multiverse brought me back several years, reminding us all why we all love this character in the first place. It was an honor to add to the legacy of your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Spider-Man No Way Home is in theaters now. It stars Holland, Zendaya, Willem Dafoe, Alfred Molina, and J.K. Simmons, among other exciting returning stars." Okay, I'm sorry. I did get a little angry there. I'm sorry for the use of the R word. And I am genuinely sorry if I insulted anyone. Because I support people who are special needs or mentally handicapped. I don't usually say that word. Okay, I was pushed to that point. That's how angry I was at that asshole Jack King, or whatever the fuck his name was. Okay. Whew, I'm back. Max is back. Finding my center. Finding my chi. And let's get into the next section of the pod, which is probably what I actually wanted to talk about today, which is a movie called The Great Train Robbery. Now, I thought this movie was directed by Philip Kaufman. It turned out that it was directed by Michael Crichton. It's interesting that it ended up being Steven Spielberg's birthday today. I didn't even know it was. And weirdly, it was also Brad Pitt's birthday today. And somebody else, maybe like two other people, but I can't think of who they were, all have their birthdays today, December 18th. For whatever reason, today is like a big day for famous people's birthdays. Okay, so anyway. What was I saying? The Great Train Robbery. Oh yeah, Michael Crichton. He wrote and directed it. Now, honestly, I am a fan of Michael Crichton as a filmmaker. I'm a fan of him as a writer and novelist, sort of. I mean, I read Jurassic Park. I never finished it. I actually didn't even get that far in it. I was kind of like, I don't know. I was like, this kind of sucks. I just like, it wasn't like the movie at all. And to me, that movie is Jurassic Park. Like, it's actually not the book, even though it's based on the book. It's sort of like Jaws, actually. Although, and I've never read Jaws, but apparently it's like not actually like a very good book, even though it's a great film, a great movie. That Jaws is one that I would call a movie, with a capital M. All caps, actually. Okay, so where was I going with that? Yeah, I'm, like, really high. Oh, that's actually another thing I wanted to talk about. I have this creeper weed, so this shit will creep up on you, it grows on you, and it's really nice, this jiggler, it's really nice buds. And I swear to God, I was sitting at the dinner table tonight, and I was dying. It was, like, torture. I had to listen to these women talk, and I'm just sitting there, like, all I want to do is smoke weed. And then I had to do the fucking dishes, take the fucking trash out. What am I, the fucking family dog here? Feed me scraps and shit. I couldn't even eat. Probably partly because of that fucking sandwich. That shit's gonna haunt me. But I was like, fuck it. I'm not gonna throw out a whole fucking sandwich. It's not rotten yet. I can eat some of it. I'm fine. I didn't die. Alright, so I'm not even really sick. I feel so much better now that I'm stoned. What was I doing? So The Great Train Robbery. This is a movie about keys. To me, this is what the movie is about. It's about keys. And it was interesting because as I was driving home, I was once again listening to the Discoveries of 2021 episode from Pure Cinema Podcast with very special guests, Quentin Tarantino and Roger Avery. I swear to God, I listen to that podcast episode every day. I'll probably end up listening to it more than any other podcast episode. I think it's my favorite podcast episode of all time. Just hearing the two of them, Quentin Tarantino and Roger Avery, I've never heard them in an interview together. I mean, Roger Avery, I don't know if I'd ever even heard him speak before I heard the Brett Easton Ellis interview. That he actually said on the podcast that was his first podcast he ever did. Oh, no, he didn't say that. He said, I'd done one other one, I think is what he said. Which, of course, you know, was must have been the Brady Snell's one. Okay, so the Great Train Robbery. Oh, yeah, so Quentin Tarantino mentioned a movie called The Crimson Key. This was one of his discoveries of 2021. And I really want to watch that movie. And apparently it's on YouTube for free, possibly on PizzaFlix. And I will probably be watching that tonight. And I think it's kind of like a perfect pseudo double feature. I'm watching them a night apart, so it's not actually a double feature. But, all right, let me read the description of The Great Train Robbery. And yes, I'm excited for The Crimson Key, and that's a little preview of tomorrow's episode. Ooh, what else did I want to talk about? I think I just remembered. I'm going to get into some music talk after this. But first, The Great Train Robbery. Original title, The First Great Train Robbery. From 1978, rated PG. 1 hour, 50 minutes. And by the way, this is the kind of movie that Hollywood doesn't make anymore. It's kind of like a fun, big budget, kind of glossy, beautiful. Well, it's not, I wouldn't call it beautiful. You know, Michael Crichton isn't a great director, and he's not like this amazing visual stylist, you know. His films are visual, and this one had a nice look to it and a sort of grandeur to it. But, I don't know. He's not like a visual master, but he's definitely a good writer. His scripts are always good. The dialogue's good in this. Like, really good in some scenes. And it's, yeah, it's just well written, and it's fun, you know what I mean? And it has, like, a certain energy to it, and it's interesting. The ideas are interesting. I'm kind of talking about Michael Crichton's cinema in general. I'm a fan of his movie Coma. That's his best movie by far. I also like Westworld. I did not like the show, but I did like the original Michael Crichton movie. And then the other thing about The Great Train Robbery that I dig is the acting. I love Sean Connery. Love him. Loved him since I was a kid. Always my favorite Bond. Always will be. And as far as Donald Sutherland goes, I'm a fan. I like Donald Sutherland. I for some reason have trouble with his last name. I don't know why. There aren't many words that I have like trouble, like, I don't know, it just doesn't roll off the tongue for me. Donald Sutherland, I want to have, like, a Boston accent when I say it. Donald Sutherland, that, like, I'm gonna just say it like that. All right, so, anyway, what I realized while watching this movie is that Donald Sutherland is, oh, there we go, he's a better actor than Sean Connery, which is something that I'd never thought about. I'd never, like, put those two together. I don't know if they were ever in another movie together. I've never seen them in a movie together. Not that I can think of. But, yeah, he's the superior actor, and he has a certain charisma. Actually, Donald Sutherland does. That Sean Connery doesn't, actually, in a way. Sean Connery has a ton of charisma. I mean, the guy's dripping with charisma. And he's very handsome, and he has an amazing voice, and he's a good actor. He's a solid actor. But he's just a little bit, like, stiffer than Sutherland. Sutherland has, like, this certain, I don't know, this slinkiness to him, and, like, he's, like, funnier, and, I don't know, Sean Connery's more serious. Okay, let me read the description from IMDb. Quote, England, 1850s. A master criminal aims to rob a train of a large sum of gold. Security is incredibly tight, and the task seems an impossible one. However, he has a plan and just the right people to carry it out. So check it out. It's called The Great Train Robbery. I want to keep recording, but I feel like, you know what, I'm going to stop the episode, and then I'm going to keep recording. Should I just end the fucking episode? I don't know. Am I rambling too much? I wanted to read a Pitchfork article, but I could save that for tomorrow. Alright. Peace. Just kidding, I'm back. It's me, Maxwell Haddad. And you're listening to Video Nasties. Thank you for listening. I want to finish up the great train robbery. And this is actually based on his novel. I would like to read the novel. It's interesting. It's like takes place in Victorian times, in the Victorian era, I think. I'm not quite sure. Did it say that in the description that I just read? I don't even fucking know. So the budget was $6 million estimated, which in 1979 constitutes a big budget movie, I suppose. I don't see why not. Oh, The 13th Warrior. I like that movie, too. Yeah, I don't know. I like Michael Crichton's movies. I don't know. I just like when people do something different. Like, I was thinking about this with, like, that band Blood Incantation that I was talking about. How they made an ambient album that's coming out. Like, I just like when, like, somebody does one thing, but then they do something different. And, like, you know, like, Tarantino's writing books now, and I just, like, I love that. And, like, Rob Zombie was, like, this rock star, and then he started making horror movies, and then they, like, actually ended up being dope. And, I don't know, I just, like, I became, like, a Rob Zombie fan because of his movies. Like, I always, you know, I like that song, Dragula, and, yeah, so I always thought that song was fucking dope, but, like, I was never, like, a Rob Zombie fan, but The Devil's Rejects is one of my favorite movies of that decade, of the 2000s. Alright, so, text facts. So this is The Great Train Robbery. Sound mix, Dolby Stereo, color, and black and white. I don't remember black and white. Well, I don't know. I was stoned. Aspect ratio, 1.85:1. Cameras and lenses by Panavision. Laboratory, Technicolor, London, UK. Negative format, 35mm. Cinematographic process, spherical. Printed film format, 35mm. All right, so you get the idea. That's a Great Train Robbery. Check it out if you haven't seen it. It's on Canopy. I've been watching stuff on my laptop, so that's where I've been watching it. Yeah, so Michael Crichton died in 2008. He was 66. I actually had a chance to see the man in person. He came to my local library, the Guilford Public Library. I grew up in Guilford, Connecticut. And he came to the library there, and he gave a talk, and I was kind of like, I got there late, I was way in the back, I was kind of like totally bored. Wait, Westworld was before Coma? Westworld was 5 years before Coma, and not only that, Coma and The Great Train Robbery are the same year, they're both 1978. Not only that, I forgot about his 80s movies. Okay, this dude is like a dope filmmaker. Like, he had a dope career as a filmmaker, just, like, separate from his novels. He was, like, this crazy famous popular novelist. What a crazy life. Uncredited as the director of The 13th Warrior? How is that possible? Oh, John McTiernan! My boy. There was actually an article, I don't know if that was on Collider, too. Or if that's on Joe Blow. I don't know who does those articles. It's like, what the fuck happened to... Oh, Eaters of the Dead. That is a dope name. That's the name of the book that The 13th Warrior was based on, written by Michael Crichton. Okay, I got it. So 80s Crichton, Looker, 1981, Runaway, 1984, Physical Evidence, 1989. I don't know that one as much. Runaway looks fucking dope. I heard, somebody was talking about these. Might have even been Tarantino, but I don't think it was. Here's the plot of Looker. Quote, 3 of 4 models who had plastic surgery done by Larry after a computed list. What the fuck does that mean? After a computed list are dead. Neither the cops nor Larry believe they're suicides. Larry investigates and stays with the 4th model. Who's behind the lists and murders? and Runaway, quote, "In the near future, a police officer specializes in malfunctioning robots. When a robot turns out to have been programmed to kill, he begins to uncover a homicidal plot to create killer robots, and his son becomes a target." Sorry, I just kind of zoned while I was reading that. Anyway, you get the idea. That's 80s Crichton in terms of his film career. Now, I'm very stoned. I'm tired, ready for bed. So I'm going to read this article real quick. This is the best jazz and experimental music of 2021 from Pitchfork. I don't know if I'm even going to get through all these. The Heart pumps Kool-Aid from Orange Milk, and the band is an unpronounceable symbol. Anthony Joseph, the rich are only defeated when running for their lives. No, the rich are only defeated when running for their lives, from Heavenly Sweetness. Aruj Aftab, Vulture Prince from New Amsterdam. Quote, "When the Pakistani singer Aruj Aftab started recording Vulture Prince, she had no plans for an elegy. But then her brother died, as did a close friend. In tracing the shape of these new absences in her life, her mind went to the Urdu ghazals of her childhood, music and poetry filled with boundless, near erotic longing for God. Aftab reimagined these ghazals, scored for only soft stringed instruments, harp, stand-up bass, acoustic guitar, some violin. These sounds call clearly to each other across moonlit space, and Aftab's voice cuts a path through the darkness in front of it. One line, one football." My bad. "One line, one footfall at a time." "Jarred out of time, her grief and ours softens and grows overwhelmingly beautiful." Jason Green. Now, I didn't think the album was that great. This looks interesting. Arushi Jane, Richer Than Blood, Brooklyn. Leaving. Quote, "Richer Than Blood, the opening track on Brooklyn-based composer Arushi Jane's debut album, Under the Lilac Sky, is deceptively simple. It only consists of two elements, her gentle vocals and the burbling drones of a modular synth. And yet, Jane makes each tool at her disposal feel so much grander. She layers her vocals to sound like a room full of singers harmonizing with each other, and she uses her synth to mimic the effect of an entire string orchestra tuning their instruments before a performance. It's an introduction that leaves you breathlessly anticipating whatever comes next." Sam Sadomsky. I want to check that one out. And that reminds me of something I did want to talk about, which is, like, I was kind of nervous for music. Like, at a certain point, I think it was, like, 2014, I'm thinking, like, FKA Twigs, like, her first album, like, that era. I was really worried about music, because I just thought everything was going to sound like that album, kind of. Like, I just thought everything was going to turn to, like, kind of, like, faux R&B, sort of, like, what am I trying to say here? Like, basically electronic. Like, everything, like, is beat-based and electronic and made with Pro Tools, and it's all synths, and it's all that kind of, like, weird, spacey, dreamy, like, dream pop kind of sound, which is actually also, like, the Drake sound, like, kind of, like, new R&B, like, sing-songy, hip-hop kind of stuff. And I just thought everything was going to sound like that. I don't really even know why. It just seemed like everything that year was kind of, like, just sounding the same. And, like, and that album was pretty good. Like, I liked it, the Twigs album. But, like, I don't know. I thought that was it. I kind of thought music was over. And then, I don't know, since then, shit has changed, and shit has gotten better, and shit has, like, expanded, And I was thinking about it today, like everything is niche now, I guess, or that's the theory anyway. And maybe that's like not such a bad thing. Maybe that's kind of a good thing. Maybe that just allows me to get even deeper into movies. But now I'm going to talk about music some more. Okay, next up, Carmen Q. Rothwell, Don't Get Comfy, slash Nowhere, Ruination. Chris Corsano, Bill Orchid, Made Out of Sound from Palilalia. Quote, with its first notes, Made Out of Sound departs from previous recordings by the long-running free improv team of guitarist Bill Orcutt and drummer Chris Corsano. There are two guitarists here, not just one. Where albums like 2018's Brace Up had the searing in-the-moment intensity of live documents, this one was assembled remotely from opposite coasts. Rather than try to mask the artifice, Orchid leans into it by doubling himself, turning their duo into a virtual trio. Perhaps as a result, Made Out of Sound is oceanic, where past records were pointillistic, enveloping you in waves of harmony rather than pushing you through through hairpin turns. The overdubs and the chiaroscuro cover photo suggests an affinity with Odds Against Tomorrow, Orchid's solo masterpiece from 2019. Like that record, Made Out of Sound is often breathtakingly beautiful, albeit in conventional ways, finding moments of serenity and contemplation amid the turbulence. Andy Cush. Circuit Dayu, Dogma from Matador. All right, I'll read it. It's from Matador. Quote, a dear friend's death, a lonely artist's residency, an intractable bout of writer's block. Circuit Dayu mastermind Haley Four was having a hell of a hard go of things. Dogma, the militantly life rock track on IO, an album of otherwise pillowy orchestral dimensions, serves as Four's stubborn note to self. Keep moving and keep busy, and you might just keep it together. Quote, tell me how to feel right, slash, tell me how to see the light. She commands over drums so mighty they stanch the synthesizer din creeping beneath her. Through this forward motion, she cultivates the strength to survive, at least until answers about what's next come easier. Grayson Haver Curran. I know, I read slash instead of just reading it like music. Okay, next up, Claire Rousset, A Softer Focus, American Dreams. Kind of like that title. Quote, scattered throughout Claire Rousset's A Softer Focus are snippets of her daily life, the sounds of a typewriter, a blaring swirl of cicadas, barely audible conversations, swathed in swells of drone, half-remembered melodies, and strings saturated with melancholy. These prosaic sounds become monumental, activating a powerful sense of nostalgia for moments of quiet reflection and human connection. The abstract pieces on A Softer Focus are made potent by their suggestive familiarity. Each sound a potential trigger for our own memories, happy, sad, or more likely, somewhere in between. Jonathan Williger. Dean Blunt, Black Metal 2, Rough Trade. Quote, the latest cryptic transmission from British singer-songwriter Dean Blunt is unsparing yet beautiful in its quest for hope in an increasingly in an increasingly despondent world. Blunt refuses allegiance to any single ideology, preferring instead to sprinkle provocative questions about black rage before vanishing into the shadows. He perfects this approach in the taunting yet empathetic final lines of Mugu. Quote, let it out, nigga, let it out, he sighs. Show them crackers what you're all about. I want to listen to this album. Black Metal 2 doesn't concede any of Dean Blunt's mystique, but it's the closest to a straight answer he's given yet. Brandon Callender. Eli Kessler, or Kessler? Kessler, I think. Icons, Lucky Me. Quote, when the COVID-19 shutdown kept people inside, percussionist and composer Eli Kessler turned his attention to the emptied streets. Icons uses on-location recordings of an uncharacteristically calm pandemic-era New York City to frame foreboding ambient mood pieces defined by vibraphone, glockenspiel, piano, and drums. An uneasy percussive skitter underlies the gleaming sound of Gamelan? I don't know how to say that word. Gamelan? 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 Bars on Evenfall, and Kessler finds a similar impressionistic beauty in the still of decline throughout the album. End of quote. Evan Minsker. Okay, this one I started last night, and yeah, I'm kind of digging it. It's Fire Tools with Eternal Home from Haosu Mountain. I don't know if that's their own label. I'm not sure. Quote, in the 80s and 90s, thrifty punk bands sometimes dubbed albums onto cassettes that they'd gotten or stolen for free from Christians or motivational speakers. If you focused your ears, you might catch a hint of the original audio grayed out between blasts of hardcore. Angel Mark Cloyd's Eternal Home operates on a similar principle. It's a bizarre palimpsest piling up layers of progressive rock, Weather Channel synths, classical minimalism, IDM beat trickery, and screamo. Unlike those lo-fi tapes of yore, though, the Chicago musician's work is almost shockingly high-def. Every grunge-inspired guitar solo, DX7 chime, and larynx-shredding howl leaping from the speakers in a blast of finely chiseled violence. Yet for all the sensory overload of Mark Cloyd's 78-minute opus, Eternal Home makes for a surprisingly immersive and even welcoming listen once you acclimate to its Everything Goes to 11 aesthetics. And if you're looking for hidden messages, Mark Cloyd's mantra-like lyrics, quote, I'm owed strength now, quote, we may as well be mushrooms, offer plenty to puzzle over, buried beneath the barrage of stimuli. Philip Sherburne. Okay, this one I started, I was a little bored by it, I have to admit, but it's good. It's nice. This is one that's been talked about a lot this year. It's Floating Points / Pharoah Sanders and the London Symphony Orchestra with Promises from Luwak Bop. Quote, it begins atomically, with a building block made of seven notes twisting around like a helix. Around this motif, Promises blinks to life, a self-regenerating ecosystem in nine movements. This hybrid electronic jazz orchestral piece doesn't feel composed so much as monitored by Sam Shepard, the boundless electronic composer who performs as Floating Points. Whether arranging the London Symphony Orchestra's oceanic swells or tapping out notes on a harpsichord that seems to be falling slightly out of tune, Shepard lays down a framework for the eminent free jazz saxophonist Pharoah Sanders to follow and then thrillingly disregard. Sanders is the central voice and shining star of Promises, his first major recording in a couple of decades, and one of 2021's greatest musical gifts. He trots to one idea, floats to another, then sprints to a third, exploring the universe Shepard has cast for him and spitting out new meanings for its restless, incessant, seven-note central motif. This is the endless joy of Promises, listening to Sanders feel his way through this alien world as if newly born into it. It leaves such a unique impression that although you are listening to music, you are also witnessing its evolution. Jeremy D. Larson. Grouper, Shade, Cranky. Quote, Grouper's Liz Harris pulls you in close on Shade. Her new songs are uncharacteristically intimate, offering quiet truths and rapturous noise that require close focus. The individual components feel familiar, the hushed vocals, tape hiss, and sound of fingertips sliding up guitar strings. But Harris's fingerpicked melodies and gutting poetry manage to explore new depths of her bottomless sound. Lean in enough, and you'll hear her ponder the light and the clouds, contending with the gravitational pull of darkness. Quote, bury those thoughts real deep, bury those bodies deep, put us back to sleep. It's a crushing flash of insight delivered like a whispered secret. Evan Minsker. Lorraine Fatigue, I liked this album, from Mexican Summer. Quote, in the hands of Brooklyn artist Taja Cheek. Music can be non-linear and unpredictable without sacrificing grooves and hooks. Did I read this? I did read this already. This is the same description as was on the other one. Lingua Ignota, Sinner Get Ready, from Sargent House. Quote, Kristen Hader's voice, stacked tall atop itself, holds you from a terrifying height. On her latest album as Lingua Ignota, she reckons with devotion and loneliness in rural Pennsylvania, using its spare landscape and its musical and religious history as the fertile backdrop for her work. Between Appalachian instruments and prepared piano, she sings like she's on the cusp of physical collapse, running her voice ragged only for it to surge into a roar. The point where exhaustion snaps into adrenaline is her starting ground. From there, she traces the contours of human faith, gumming the jagged edges where it breaks. Sasha Geffen. This one has kind of a cool album cover. Luke Stewart and Jarvis Earnshaw Quartet. Luke Stewart and Jarvis Earnshaw Quartet. Okay, I guess it's self-titled. No quarter. Luke Stewart and Jarvis Earnshaw create a fiery set of titanic jazz, exploring the possibilities of the genre by moving from transcendental meditation to off-center bebop. I think this might be the album I listen to after I finish recording. Stewart's bass is swift, and it's easy to be left stunned by how quickly his hands seem to be running across the instrument. Earnshaw's sitar is used equally for creation and destruction, bringing the former with gentle picking and the latter with improvisation. Devin Waldman's sprightly alto sax solos and Ryan Sawyer's tempered drumming elevate the proceedings further, enhancing the sense that you are hearing the players push themselves towards something new. Hubert Adjaye Canto. Human Thing by Maddie from Leaving. Quote, a cybernetic cry into the wilderness. This single from Maddie appeared out of the ether towards the beginning of March and has yet to wear out its welcome. Produced by Maddie and Black Taffy, Human Thing is a stuttering behemoth of burnt-out snares, guttural bass, and Maddie's inimitable yelp. Lying somewhere between a club banger and an industrial rock number, this track imprisons you in its reverb in order to ask, quote, have you ever loved a human? Hubert Adjaye Canto. I want to hear that one too. Oh, here's Model Home, Both Feet, and The Infinite from Don Giovanni. I think I did listen to this one. I just don't really remember it. Quote, listening to Model Home's Both Feet and The Infinite feels like stumbling upon some mysterious radio frequency. If you bump your dial up a millimeter, you might lose it forever. The new album from the Washington, D.C. duo sounds subterranean, emanating from a basement cluttered with cables and mixing boards. Vocalist Nappy Napa and electronic tinkerer Patrick Kane take a painterly approach to their songs, shading them with strokes of space-age funk, grimy disco, and underground hip-hop. Tracks like Ambition and Body Power, with their peripheral chatter and rambling lyrics, harness the spirit of an impromptu performance at a house show, a snapshot of one night that can never be fully replicated. Madison Bloom. More Mother, Black Encyclopedia of the Air, from Anti. On her, quote, on her first release for eclectic indie mainstay, Anti, experimental noise poet More Mother transmits radical messages softly. Black Encyclopedia of the Air is far more hushed than her harsh dispatches of the past. The album nods to 90s R&B, ambient, and cosmic jazz, and is packed with features from her expanding artistic community, including Alabama's Pink Sifu and members of her own Philadelphia-based collective, Black Quantum Futurism. More Mother minds the same wreckage that she has always confronted, particularly the prolonged effects of intergenerational trauma. But here, she conquers it in a state of relative tranquility. Madison Bloom. I want to hear that one, too. Oh, okay, I love this album. Nalissa Nephro, Space 1.8, from Warp. quote, Space 1.8 earns its astronomical title through frontier-breaking ambition. Its influences are distinctly throwback. Eric Dolphy's investigations of the clarinet, both Coltrane's search for an infinite cry. But the album isn't content to replicate what worked in the past. London's Nala Sinephro, utilizing both the harp and synthesizer, guides her band through a muted rumble that pricks the ears with both small deviations and seismic overtures alike. It's heavy music delivered with a light touch. Hubert Adjai Canto. Okay, I don't know how to pronounce this one. Ran Cap Duai. Nagu Nagay 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 Tan Thay from Subtext / Multiverse. Ron Cap Duai, a trio based in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, works largely via improvisation, a practice you can hear through the boundless, structureless recordings on their debut album, Nagu Nagay 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 Tan Thay. The group then stitches together those pieces digitally, a process that becomes evident through the abrupt cuts and shifts that make the album feel like a glitching psychedelic collage, inverting the atmosphere right when you think they've settled into a groove. Often, they highlight the ghostly in-between states of their performances, as in the highlight Aztec Glue, which incorporates their closest thing to a conventional melody between a staticky procession of pulsing synths. By the time you think you've figured out what this sound is, they've already moved on to a new one. This volatility may be the point. Sam Sadomski. I want to hear that one too. Rosie Lowe, Duvall, Timothy Sun from Carrying Color. Quote, the emotions that Duvall Timothy can unleash with a simple series of chords is unparalleled. And on this collaborative album with the English singer Rosie Lowe, he manages to make 20 minutes feel like an eternity. On the titular track, Lowe's vocals are transformed from a whispered lullaby to a firmament-shaking choir. With minimal instrumentation, the two create a towering hymn that yawns into the distance. It's the type of album where each track has enough gravitas to be an album closer, yet the actual conclusion, Gonna Be, manages to reach a level of intensity that catches you in your throat. High-pitched voices sing, quote, Gonna Be, and they are paired with piano and double bass, played by Tom Herbert. As the song ends, only the double bass is left playing, delivering you into its mighty resonance, or resonance. Hubert Adjai Canto. Okay, this album I want to hear too. Shub Saran, English, self-released. English, that's English with an I. The second full length from guitarist, composer, and producer Shub Saran sprouted from several entwined roots. The Bangladesh-born son of Indian diplomats, Saran lived in Dhaka, Cairo, Geneva, New Delhi, Toronto, and Boston before planting himself in New York City around 2014. Saran's new album is a product of his multinational upbringing, incorporating Middle Eastern folk, progressive rock, Indian classical, and more in its unique jazz fusion. English places bright electric guitar and modular synthesizers alongside instruments from India and the Middle East, often within the same song. Sprawling opener End Culture begins as a high-speed race through the desert before careening into stretches of free jazz piano and skronking synth rim. Okay, I'm getting tongue-tied. And skronking synth riffs that nod to Stevie Wonder's Higher Ground. With these discrete elements, Saran forms a language all his own. Madison Bloom. Spelling, that's spelling with three L's, Little Deer from Sacred Bones. Quote, Bay Area art pop sorcerer Tia Cabral of Spelling reintroduced herself with Little Deer, the surging Baroque opener of her fantastical third album, The Turning Wheel. Evoking the audacious spirits of forebears like Minnie Riperton and Kate Bush, it is a fable-like tale of death and rebirth, of the never-quite-finished process of being a person. Joined by over a dozen musicians, brass, strings, woodwinds, conga, a choir, Cabral brings pop formalism and the questing spirit of 70s soul orchestration into Spelling's world, making a majestic entry into her sharpest album yet, Jen Pelly. Terza Color Grade from Domino. Like I said, Wasn't a big fan. I liked one of the songs. Tomu DJ Feminista from Side Chick. Tyshawn Sorry / King Britt Untitled One, The Buddy System. BJ Iyer, Linda May, Han O, Tyshawn Sorry, Uneasy from ECM. Quote, jazz maestro VJ Iyer articulates the urgency of protest without shirking the sentimental on this album recorded with longtime collaborators Linda May, Han O, and Tyshawn Sorry. Iyer's pin-heeled piano work hot steps around in search of a sacred chord to alight upon, leaving shallow punctures across your heart as O and Sorry's storm-flung rhythm section executes stomach-lurching shifts. Volatility abounds. The raucous peon combat breathing honors Eric Garner and Black Lives Matter with music that's by turns fluid and transfixed. The sound of righteous fury opening channels for electricity to course between the many. Jazz Monroe. That's it. I'm signing off. My name is Maxwell Haddad. Holy shit. Oh, wait. Oh, no, that's what I was expecting. Yeah, okay. Never mind. Sorry, I was just looking at the length. Okay, I'm signing off. My name is Maxwell Haddad. This show is called Video Nasties. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow the show on Instagram at Vide. That's V-I-D-E dot O-Nasties. That's O-N-A-S-T-I-E-S. I'm signing off for now. I will talk to you very soon, as in tomorrow night. I know it's late tonight, but it's an extra long episode, so I hope you enjoy that. Or I should say it's a long episode. Episodes will be getting longer from here on out. I hope for you that's a good thing. For me, it is a good thing. And sometimes I just get in a groove. Some nights it happens, or sometimes during the day. The episodes that I record during the day on my days off tend to be the longer ones anyway. But this is a longer episode for you because I felt like talking tonight. So, peace.